From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning we speak with speaking expert and coach Bill McGowan. He's the author of a new book called Speak Memorably, about how to be better at public speaking, whether it's for business, school, or just feeling able to speak up in a group, and how to ensure that you and your message are as effective, engaging, and yes, memorable as possible. And then we'll speak with investigative reporter Murray Carpenter, who exposes not only the true health dangers of sugary sodas, but the massive campaign of disinformation and scientific manipulation that beverage companies, and specifically the Coca-Cola Company, have conducted for decades to keep America's most iconic beverage on top. We'll be right back after a word from our underwriters. Stay with us.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. In today's cacophony of 24/7 tech, incessant TikToks, and endless Zoom meetings, it's becoming harder than ever to have our ideas and selves be heard and remembered above all the noise. But today's guest, former journalist and longtime speaking maestro and trainer Bill McGowan, can help you take your communication game to a whole new level, no matter how skilled or natural a speaker you might already be. With concrete strategies and helpful tips you probably haven't heard before, Bill assures us that communicating with charisma is a skill, not a gift, and that with the right tactics and motivation, we can all speak in a way that's enjoyable for listeners and that helps our messages stick more effectively in our audience's mind. Bill McGowan, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Mary Beth, it's so nice to be with you. Thanks for the invite.
My pleasure. Tell us a little bit about what brought you to the moment of writing this book called Speak Memorably.
We had to remember that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I coach and have coached over 25 years, thousands upon thousands of people, probably 30,000 hours of training. And one of the things that I come away with from hearing most people's presentation or the speech they have to deliver is that it really doesn't stick in my mind. It's a little bit disposable, a little bit forgettable. It sounds a lot like so many other presentations I heard last week and the week before that. And very, very few people stand out and are distinctive. And if you can't have your message stick in people's minds, you have a much lesser chance of motivating them, influencing them, persuading them, making them feel something or acting on something that you want them to act on, or maybe even just buy into an idea that you have. And so in my private coaching sessions, we work very hard on how to say things that make you stand out above all the others and have your message really stick and resonate.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. And like in the intro, there is so much stimulation and information coming at us all the time. I think we've started becoming a little bit more protective almost. There's more of a filter. So we have to, as speakers or people trying to provide interesting messages for folks, find ways to penetrate that.
Yeah, and I think when we hear someone speak, there's so much going on in everybody's minds right now. There's so much clutter and so much demand on our time and attention that literally within the first 6-7 seconds of you speaking to an audience of people, the audience is making a half a dozen value judgments about you. Are you credible? Are you trustworthy? Do you know your material? Are you worth listening to? And those are very important determinations that your audience is coming to. And it's vital that you get out of the starting blocks crisp and clean, and that you have a game plan from word one. Most people get up to talk, and somewhere down the road, maybe a minute or a minute and a half later, is the beginning of their presentation or their speech. And there's this phenomenon we call the presentation chasm that people fall headfirst into.
Oh, tell us about that.
Yeah, it separates the pleasantries, which is, hey, good morning, great to see everybody, terrific, really thrilled to be here, and the content of maybe your first slide, if that's what you're using for this presentation. there is a gap between the pleasantries and the presentation that is about 30, 40 seconds long, where most people have absolutely no idea what the next word coming out of their mouth is. It is all ad-libbed. It is all spontaneous. And as a result, it's usually a mess. And it usually necessitates the speaker to say at some point, all right, so I guess we should get started. Those are words that should never come out of anybody's mouth ever. Oh. And it's just ironic to me that in the time frame where your audience is making the keenest judgments about you, you should be the most planned, not the least planned about what you're going to say.
Sure, that makes a ton of sense. So, well, give us a little instruction. What can we do if you know that you're going to speak in front of some people to make that initial 30 seconds of making that impression strong?
Well, what you should definitely not do is what 90% of presenters do, and that is go straight to the agenda slide. There is probably no least effective way of grabbing and hooking your audience than an agenda slide. If you think about it, in the history of reading and in the history of bookstores, nobody has ever gone into a bookstore and bought a book and said, wow, I can't wait to go home and rip open that table of contents. You know, no one has ever said that in the history of reading. And when you put up an agenda slide, it's essentially sending a message to your audience. Okay, the real presentation is probably going to happen in about 30, 40, 60 seconds from now. You don't have to pay attention until then. So we have a motto about presenting, which is inform, don't warn, meaning stop warning people about what you're about to do in the presentation. Just do it. Just inform people, inspire them, give them insights. So if you're not going to do the agenda slide, what should you do? Well, it'd be great if you had some story that you could start with that is metaphorically connected to the thrust of what you're saying in your talk or your presentation. There was a chief technical officer at one of the tech firms who got up at a conference, and he started with, you know, in 1954, Roger Bannister became the first human to break the 4-minute mile. The only thing on the screen behind him was the number 4 minutes. And I've had people say, wait a minute, if I got up and started like that, don't you think the audience would be sitting there absolutely wondering where the heck is he going with this thing? And my answer to that is, that's fine. That is a form of it.
Yeah, that's okay.
Right. You have them mentally chewing on something now. And so it's really important to have that opening story. But maybe more importantly, you need to have what we call a through line. And the through line is what connects the story to the point of what you're there to communicate. And then you can get into your presentation.
And then what, after that initial story and you've got a through line, do you start right away with your thesis or do you wind your way around to it? What do we do next?
It's better to not show your work in a presentation. And I had somebody in venture capital say that to me last year. I said, you know, you don't need to give them all the details. It's better for you to give your point of view. And he said, oh, you mean don't show my work? I said, exactly what I mean. And it's better to tell an audience how it is, what you think, what the future looks like, and then tell them the rationale behind that decision, as opposed to the flip side, which is give all the evidence, build this ironclad case for the eventual reveal of your reality or the reality as you see it. And I think that coming out with the goods right away and then explaining it is a much better way to grip your audience. But you know, the thing about stories, Mary Beth, is that they've done some interesting studies that show that if you take factual information and you embed them within stories, your information becomes 22 times more memorable to your audience than just fire hosing stats and facts and information at people. So weaving them in really brings you tremendous benefits.
Well, that makes sense, even when you think of watching a historical-based movie or reading a historical fiction, how much the events and the order of things and those facts stay in your mind in such a different way, don't they?
Absolutely. There's science behind being able to describe things in terms of positioning and props. It's called the theory of loci. And it means that if you can show that things exist in places, that the memory is also triggered by that as well.
What about people who say, you know, I should open with a joke, but they don't consider themselves a particularly funny person? How should humor fit into the public speaking realm?
Humor is definitely the ultimate high wire act of public speaking. There's no question about it. We've all heard that. Oh, start with a joke. They'll love it. They'll be in the palm of your hand. And the only public speaking advice worse than that is picture the audience in their underwear. That's the only one that is actually worse. But at the same time, there's nothing better than getting a laugh out of the audience. It relaxes you, it relaxes them, and it can cut tension, it can connect you to the audience. It's been scientifically proven to foster trust, to elevate trust. It actually releases dopamine in the minds and the bodies of your audience, what's called the pathway to pleasure. You know, laughter also releases endorphins in the audience's brain. The Mayo Clinic has done studies on this. But it's not a great idea to just randomly tell a joke. It'd be better to find a humorous lens through which to see the topic that you're talking to your audience about. It's not a good idea to do stand-up. Leave that to the professional comedians. But humor does have a huge role to play in engagement and retention. So finding ways to weave it in is really beneficial.
Without enlarging that chasm between making everyone feel comfortable and the actual stuff. So there's some through line, I imagine, is an important part of that.
Right. Well, you do have the random joke. Ultimately, what you're going to have to say is, all right, so I guess we should get started now. You know, I mean, it goes back to that line you're constantly trying to avoid.
Yeah, I think I will never be able to hear a speaker and not notice that now. That's going to be a part of every experience, I fear.
And the other thing, Mary Beth, you'll always notice from now on is how many times people talk about what they're going to talk about. So I want to talk a little bit today about topic X, and then I want to delve into this. But before I do that, let me take a couple steps back. It's all this traffic cop stuff that, you know, here's the order and here's what I'm going to do. And I'm giving you a heads up that I'm about to do it. And instead of just doing it.
Yeah, that's the showing the work.
Right.
So in Toastmasters, which is, you know, a popular organization and helpful for a lot of people, especially if they're very nervous speakers, they tell you to do that. They say, tell the three things you're going to talk about the three things, and then tell the three things you just talked about. So maybe that's helpful for structuring the talk for yourself so that you can do it. But what's the better way to do it?
I have a lot of respect for Toastmasters. I think they're a great organization.
Sure.
And people have gotten tremendous benefit from Toastmasters. I would encourage everybody to at least have that be one of their starting points. But that is definitely the McKinsey method about tell them what you're going to tell them and tell them what you told them. You know, that's been in existence for a long time. And it's a little bit of a tired formula. I heard this fascinating interview with Francis Ford Coppola, and Fareed Zakaria on CNN was interviewing him, and he asked him, do you have a particular formula for making a movie? And he said, well, I learned years ago that you should take your three best things, and you should take your best thing and finish with it. Take your second best thing and lead with it, and find some logical, thematic place in the middle to put your third best thing. He's talking about movie making, but movie making, doing presentations, they're all forms of storytelling. And it's a formula that I've definitely employed with the people whom I coach, in that the beginning and the end don't radically have to be something different. They can communicate the same idea, but I'd love for people to be able to articulate it slightly differently. I don't want it to be a verbatim duplication of what was said in the first 30 seconds. Your first 30 seconds and your last 30 seconds can hit on the same idea, but they should sound different.
That makes a ton of sense. That advice works really well with musician performances too. You want to have your great big leaving moment, your probably your best, your most famous song, but you also want to catch people's attention right at the beginning. So I'm gonna remember that. And I'm a big fan of Coppola's wisdom about arts. So
and it is backed up by this something called the primacy recency effect, which studies have shown that people's retention and engagement is very strong in the beginning, and then it sags in the middle, and then it comes back up very strong at the end.
What's that called again?
The primacy recency effect.
Oh, I like that. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, you have a group of strategies called the Magnificent Seven that you highlight in your book, and I think these are fantastic. I don't know if we have time for all of them, but could you highlight a couple of those for people who want to add some new tools to their speaking box?
Sure. People love analogies. Analogies are an effective tool because if you're talking about something that may be foreign and unfamiliar to your audience, an analogy or a metaphor quickly allows them to understand it because you're comparing it to something common to everyone's experience. That's the value of an analogy. So metaphors, analogies are very powerful. Mark Benioff had a great one years ago, the CEO of Salesforce. He said, Facebook is the new cigarettes. It's addictive. It's based on false advertising. It's bad for you. And therefore it should be regulated. And it was a well-crafted analogy that got a lot of headlines. There's also something that I call a creative label, which is essentially an expression you coin. So the Great Resignation is a creative label. Quiet quitting is a creative label. Years ago, the founders of Google were asked about their criteria for investing in or acquiring another company. And they said, well, it's got to be a product or service you use twice a day, every day. It's got to pass the toothbrush test. And that creative label of the toothbrush test became this thing that got a viral life to it, and everybody really understood what it meant. If you're a fan of Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm, every episode of Larry David is based on a creative label. Stop and Chat, Chat and Cut, The Big Goodbye, Siren Abuse. He's made a living on the creative label.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, and it kind of shows that you have a specific point of view and maybe a fresh point of view. If you're able to come up with this creative label, you've done a little bit of pre-work in figuring out something innovative to share, right?
Right. The Goldilocks economy was an expression coined years ago, but not too hot, not too cold, just about right. Alan Greenspan, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve, talked about irrational exuberance. Mm-hmm. And that line just got repeated over and over and over again. So again, definitely be something that really sticks in people's minds.
I love that. What about twisted cliches? I loved seeing that one in your book.
Well, it's funny. I was trying to come up with a title for this book. And for a few minutes, I entertained the idea of using what I call a twisted cliche, which is taking a really common or overused expression and just changing it slightly to make it something new. And so I was toying with naming the book Putting on the Riz instead of Putting on the Riz.
My sixth grader would have really liked that.
At least sixth grader would have loved that. But the problem is we had an age gap there, right? Putting on the Riz goes way back into the, decades and decades, and Riz is a little bit more modern. So I might have lost a lot of people there. But we talked about in the tech world the need to be fast, and a twisted cliche there would be a twist on Darwin being it's a survival of the quickest, instead of survival of the fittest. These slight twists on really common, well-known expressions can be very, very effective.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely check out Bill McGowan's book called Speak Memorably, The Art of Captivating an Audience. We are speaking with him about how to be a more captivating public speaker and hopefully help your message stick more firmly in the minds of overwhelmed folks. What do you do as a speaker if you sense your audience is drifting? Because a lot of people seem to just start speaking louder and faster, and that doesn't always help. So what do you suggest?
That definitely will make your your presentation spiral faster downward. And when you go faster, it's almost an admission that I know I'm losing you here. So I know you're bored, so I'll speak fast and you'll be bored for less time. That's what speaking fast does. Or even that's what saying, I'm going to quickly give you an update on that. Quickly is inherently apologetic. It presumes your audience is not interested. Oh. Yeah, so that's one of the words we try to get people to stay away from. But there is an opportunity in the middle of a presentation, if you sense that the audience is drifting, to try to start truncating the content in each slide. Get to the point earlier. Don't rush, but start pruning away what you think is secondary information.
Okay.
And one of the things that can be very difficult to achieve this is a PowerPoint or a keynote deck that is just loaded with information on it. See, if you have a slide behind you that has a lot of information and you gloss over the topic, you decide, I'm going to pare this way down and I'm only going to refer to this, they're visually going to know that you're not giving the material that you plan to present its due.
Ooh.
But if you've got a slide behind you that is incredibly minimal, maybe there are just 5 words on it, or there's one image on it and one number or 2 words, then you can go as long or as short as you want on each slide and no one's going to know.
Right.
I would say, I would follow your advice, Mary Beth. It was good not to go faster, but to bring the finish line of each thought closer. And one way to do this is how we prepare people for a presentation. We try not to get them memorized on what your talk track or your narration is for each slide. We want them to know, what is the crisp, declarative, concise sentence that leads the slide? What is the big idea that you're trying to convey in this slide? And that should be a short, punchy sentence as well, a simple sentence. And what does the finish line look like? How do I end this thing crisp and concise and in a memorable way? If you know those three things cold, your presentation has a much more polished, well-produced feel to it. Usually people stumble getting into the slide and getting out of the slide. And now that you know those three things and they are very concise, you can make that the skeletal structure of each slide and decide to go as long or as short as you want in and around those three things. But at least you know how to begin it, how to end it, and what's the big thing I'm trying to communicate here.
Yeah, and it gives you that flexibility so that if you find that you've talked yourself into a corner, you can kind of keep it brief. And if you notice they want more information about something, you can expand on it. That's terrific. And we're speaking with Bill McGowan, co-author of a new book called Speak Memorably. Is there one concept or tip? I mean, tip seems so shallow compared to the depth of what you're speaking about. But one thing that you'd like to really pass on to speakers who just want to connect better with audiences?
I was always intrigued by a quote from Eleanor Roosevelt. She said, everyone should do something every day that makes you a little bit uncomfortable. And I feel that way about public speaking. Every time you get up to speak in front of an audience, I think it's really valuable to road test some device, technique that you've never done before. Mm. And there are plenty in this book to sample and road test. I'm not expecting people to flip a switch and now be a radically different speaker. This is a dial that you're going to turn gradually. Each time you go out, try something new. Try something to get you out of not just your comfort zone, but what I call the conformity zone, the zone in which you sound like everybody else. You're using the same cliche expressions, the same industry jargon, the same structure to the presentation. I know we've all learned through osmosis of watching other people present, but that's not been really, those people have not been great role models. And I urge people to bust loose, try new things, and whatever you do, don't replicate the other people in your organization who you see get up and present. You should take pride in being radically different from them.
Well, Bill McGowan, this has been fascinating. We're speaking about his new book, Speak Memorably, The Art of Captivating an Audience. It has been a pleasure to speak with you, and being in an industry that requires me to speak, I am going to definitely put to work all of these great suggestions. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed the conversation, Mary Beth. Thank you.
To the Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. We all know that soda, or pop, whatever you were raised to call it, isn't a particularly healthy choice, but could it be far more problematic for our health than anyone knows? Sugar-sweetened beverages are the single most impactful item of the American diet, contributing to chronic disease, especially obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And Coca-Cola is America's favorite and highest-selling sugar-sweetened beverage by far. For years, we've been hearing from all kinds of sources that Coke and other sugary sodas aren't really all that bad. But is that true?
Well, today's guest, investigative reporter and author Murray Carpenter, would probably say a resounding no. Today, we'll discuss his findings after extensive research and deep investigative reporting about not only the overwhelming evidence that sugary soda is bad for our health, but also how the Coca-Cola company has run a brilliant, multifaceted, century-long campaign of disinformation conducted to keep profits high and consumers in the dark. Murray Carpenter, author of Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for your interest in the book.
Of course. Well, let's just start with what drew you to this topic. You've written about caffeine, and what sparked this interest in Coke?
Well, it was specifically my book on caffeine that I wrote about 11 years ago called Caffeinated. And in doing that reporting for the book, what I realized is that the caffeinated beverage that we consume most by volume is not coffee or tea, but it's sodas. And so, you know, people would ask me after I wrote that book, really, people just wanted the cliff notes. So they were like, you know, is my caffeine habit good for me or is it not? And so I would tell them, if you don't suffer from anxiety or insomnia and you're getting your caffeine from a healthy source, then, you know, knock yourself out. It's going to be fine. But if you're getting it from soda, that could be a major health problem. And so that's kind of what led me down this path into this book.
Did you have a sense all along that sodas were a particularly harmful source of caffeine, or was that something you discovered maybe through your research?
I discovered it through my research. So yeah, like as I started off, I think I felt like most Americans, we know it's not a sort of a health food, right? Sodas, and you can drink them in moderation, and they might not be good for you. But as I went along and did more reporting on this, I realized, wow, the extent of the harms are much greater, and there's a much more wider variety of harms than we recognized. And kind of as I was doing this reporting, really in the two decades, say from 2000 to 2020, is also when a lot of the really good research on the health risks of sugar-sweetened beverages was coming to light. So I think my timing was good. And yeah, as I learned more about the health risks, that's what kind of drew me to this subject. Because, I mean, the gist of it is that, as we discussed, we know it's not a health food, but most people are not really aware of the extent of the harms. And for many Americans, they have just not gotten that memo yet.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Murray Carpenter. He's the author of a new book called Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Okay, Murray, so I have some ideas about why Coca-Cola Corporation is the alleged perpetrator here and not something else. I'm assuming it has something to do with the volume, like it's the biggest company. But what else does it have to do with?
Well, so, you know, as I went along and did this, started researching this, I realized, it's the biggest company, soda company in the world. And, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, some people call it soda, some people call it pop, some people call it Coke, right? Some people just say, you know, a soda is a Coke. I mean, it's synonymous with with Coke. So, but it's huge. I mean, the Coca-Cola Corporation did, I think, $47 billion in revenue last year. I think they sell 2 billion servings of beverages, and that's, you know, not just sodas, but, you know, they do water, etc. 2 billion servings daily in over 200 countries. You know, their market capitalization, their total value as a corporation is something like $300 billion. So that's one thing. They're huge. They're far and away the industry leader. You know, if you look at the soda industry, it's not like Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper. It's really Coke and then everybody else. That's thing one. Thing two is they really have been much more aggressive, much more sophisticated, and much more effective at this sort of disinformation that became a big threat of this book.
Okay, well, I want to get into that disinformation, but first you introduce a really staggering statistic. I mean, we know that, you know, one of the big threats to our well-being is chronic disease. Chronic disease is kind of defined as the diseases of lifestyle. In other words, they could be prevented if you did the right things. Chronic disease, you give in the book, kills about 1.7 million Americans annually, and that's 21 times more than opioids, which has gotten a lot of attention, as it should have. But somehow, we just kind of go along saying things like, well, you know, the occasional Coke won't hurt you. I don't think you believe that, but I think it's also that people aren't just having the occasional Coke.
Yeah, and I'm glad you know, point that out, because one of the sort of themes of the book is chronic disease did not just happen. I mean, it's not like we were going on along as a nation and suddenly chronic disease, you know, came in from Mars and we all had it. In large measure, chronic disease happened because big food corporations learned how to really encourage us to eat far more and less healthy calories than we need. I mean, that's sort of an oversimplified way of saying it. But, you know, there are definitely other aspects to the epidemic of chronic disease, but diet is a huge one. And of the elements in the diet, as you mentioned in the intro, you know, sugar is about the worst. And of the sugars, liquid sugars are about the worst. And the way we drink most of the liquid sugars is from Coke.
I think a lot of people understand the natural connection between sugar and obesity, that kind of we're raised from an early age to understand that candy and various treats should be rare. But the connection with heart disease and cardiovascular issues is one that I don't think a lot of people are aware of. Can you tell us a little bit, I mean, without going full into the science, if you don't like, but what is that connection?
Yeah, I mean, basically, when you're consuming a great deal of sugar-sweetened beverages, or sugars in a lot of forms, but particularly in sugar-sweetened beverages, this can lead to increased cholesterol. And that's one of the things that's, you know, counterintuitive, because people think of, you know, cholesterol, you think of beef or something. But basically, right. a lot of the sugars in sugar-sweetened beverages are quickly converted to fat in your body. And that can lead to, you know, a wide range of issues, including cardiovascular disease, and high blood pressure. And so this is one of the challenges, I should say, about discussing, you know, the sugar-sweetened beverages versus, say, discussing tobacco and the health risks posed by smoking. Because if you're a smoker, there are certain conditions that you're going to get that most people are not going to, you know, get. You know, lung disease, lung cancer, emphysema, these kinds of things are, you know, they have sort of the signature of smoking. Whereas a lot of the chronic diseases that you can get, that sugar-sweetened beverages can contribute to, are things that many of us may be exposed to at different levels. And so it's really hard to say, okay, here's the smoking gun. But yeah, cardiovascular disease is a big one. And cardiovascular disease, as we know, often goes hand in glove with overweight and obesity. And so a lot of times there's a suite of conditions that come together. You know, there's kind of a vicious circle that happens too, which is, again, less easy to quantify. But once you start developing overweight and obesity, maybe you start getting high blood pressure, you may become less active because working out is just not as pleasant. and then you go down into inactivity and less health. And so, you know, it's complicated, there are a lot of issues that are directly related to consuming sugar sweetened beverages.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope once one element starts the toppling dominoes, right? Well, I'm glad you brought up big tobacco because I was fascinated by how interrelated the big tobacco and the Coca-Cola company have been as far as their strategies for disinformation and kind of using each other's models to affect the public's perception of a product. Was that surprising to you?
It was. It was one of the most surprising things that I found in researching the book is, and all credit to a researcher in California named Kristen Kearns, who was a dentist, who became kind of an archivist and health advocate. But what she realized in looking through archives is that we now have this strategy is known as the, quote, tobacco playbook. And this is what the tobacco companies did for years. And this involves, when there's science that cast doubt on your product, you suggest alternative science. You use front groups to sort of hold that science at arm's length from you. You take on PR campaigns, and it's a very sophisticated public relations strategy. But what I learned in reporting the book through the work of Kristen Kearns was that when the Sugar Research Foundation actually had started doing this stuff in the 1940s. And when the tobacco industry developed their very first PR strategy, and that was a group called the Tobacco Industry Research Committee, they hired their first staffer from this sugar association. And in his application to their organization, he described, in great detail, what is now known as the tobacco playbook. So put another way, yeah, soda developed the tobacco playbook before tobacco did.
Murray, how you've talked about the cigarette playbook model, isn't there a cigarette playbook model for undoing? And what comes to mind is how the Sackler family of Purdue Pharma, Big Pharma, they were outed and they were proven to be guilty that they knew what was going on with the opioid epidemic, and yet they kept pushing it. Where's our playbook for undoing these corporations that are harming us?
Yeah, that's a huge question. It's one that people keep thinking about. So I would say a couple of things. One, lawsuits have been pivotal, both I think with the Sackler family, and Purdue Pharma, and with tobacco. I do cover a court case in the book, and I think it suggests that it might be a little bit more of a challenge for sodas, but that's one thing. Another thing that just in terms of sort of tipping the balance slightly, I think as public opinion gets sort of sways against Coke and the sugar sweetened beverages, you might see more efforts at soda taxes, at warning labels. And once sort of that momentum builds, then I think you might see something akin to what happened with tobacco and to what happened with Purdue Pharma. But yeah, I mean, I think veterans of both of those campaigns could tell you that there were years, there were decades in which, not much visible progress was made.
Yeah, and maybe it goes back a little bit to what you were saying about how the effects of Coke on chronic inflammation, chronic diseases might be a little bit more diffuse, where, if you have smoked and then you see the lung cancer, there's a direct connection. Or if you never took opiates and you were fine, and then you took opiates and you overdosed, like there's a clear connection, but they can always pass the buck, right? And the other kind, people are drinking a lot of Starbucks. Maybe it's really a Starbucks problem, And please, dear God, don't go after Starbucks, because I really like it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Yeah, it's for those very reasons. And in one of the court cases that I discuss in the book, which was about warning labels in San Francisco, one of the judges asked the attorney for San Francisco, sort of, what will you go after next? Ice cream, I could eat enough ice cream to put me over the limit, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's a much more nuanced conversation, I think, with sodas than it was with tobacco or with opiates.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So we are at the whim of how we are marketed too, and we can be very influenced by marketing and branding. And, you know, a lot of people would say it's up to the consumer to educate themselves. We know that doesn't happen. And in a lot of instances, it can't happen. There are people who, you know, aren't able to be, you know, to have this information at their fingertips. And I just wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, because, you know, for Mary Beth and for me, you know, we know it's really obvious that you shouldn't be drinking sugary beverages, but it's not that obvious for people. What did you find as you did this research?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that, because I mean, you live in a mountain town and, you know, you see people there who are like, you know, they're like triathlons that were once considered extreme. People are doing those, you know, three times a week. It's just, I mean, there is, we live in what, you know, a culture of, I would say, bifurcated fitness, because never have we had so many people who are so fit and so many people who are so not fit. But it's the latter group, the people who are not fit, these people who have not gotten the memo. And I think you're right. We shouldn't be smug. We shouldn't say everybody should understand this. I think we should recognize that a lot of people are, you know, they're busy in their lives. They have a lot of things going on. And for whatever reason, you know, whether it's the industry, the government, their social group, they do not yet realize the risks of sugar sweetened beverages. And, you know, I spent some time in Jackson, Mississippi, doing the reporting for this book, because it's one of the places that's sort of an epicenter of chronic disease, has very high soda consumption. And if you go to some of the grocery stores there, you know, to a greater extent, I think, than what you would find in Utah, you're going to be deluged with sugar sweetened beverages. So, again, there's kind of a positive feedback loop here. You know, some communities have really gotten the memo, others have not. And in those places that have not gotten the memo, I think there's a lot more marketing to those people. And, you know, another thing that's worth noting here is just to sort of put this into context, for people like you and Mary Beth who maybe don't consume sugar-sweetened beverages, we're still consuming on average something like 10 ounces of sugar sweetened beverages per day as Americans. So for everyone like the three of us, maybe who doesn't consume them at all, that means there's, you know, someone out there who's doing like 20 ounces a day. And that is very clearly in the realm of what can give you some real health risks. So yeah, it's a really interesting challenge. There's a lot of people who don't yet recognize the risks, and it's challenging actually to understand how to, you know, more effectively get that message out there too. And there are nonprofits that are working at this.
Yeah, amazing that you would have a nonprofit that would, you know, maybe one of their greater missions would be looking at this sort of thing. Yeah. I wanted to just go back to the liquid, what did you call it? Liquid sugar drinks or something like, I think what you were saying is talking about the importance of having, if you're going to have sugar, to have fiber in there as well. So can you go into that a little bit? Because I don't know how much less healthy, how much, you know, how bad it is for you if it doesn't have fiber.
Well, and this is interesting. It gets to be kind of a nuanced conversation. I think one of your listeners would probably be, you know, interested in or aware of somewhat. So, you know, there's been so much discussion about low carb. You know, the pendulum swung so hard from, you know, low fat to low carb, and carbs have been vilified, I think, to a great extent. One of my sources put it this way. He says, look, there's a continuum of carbohydrate quality. So, you know, all the way out on one end, you have like unrefined grains. You know, you have rice or something. Towards the middle, you have, say, oatmeal. So, you know, a partially refined grain. You know, going further out towards the less healthful end of this, then you get into like refined, say, white flour. And then you get white flour. So that's crackers. Then you get white flour plus sugar, right? Then you're into like donuts and cookies, and then all the way out, anchoring the least healthful end of this continuum are the liquid sugars. And part of it, yes, you're not getting any of the other, you know, helpful elements of the diet, no fiber, you know, no protein, that you would from a normal, like a whole food. But the other thing, and this is, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but a really interesting aspect that they're finding about that makes these liquid sugars particularly unhealthful is this thing called satiety. So they don't fill you up. So you're able to consume more of them than you think you need.
Right. I remember that section in the book where the kind of equilibrium balance that the body would naturally do. Whereas if you have more calories in the morning, maybe in the evening or the next day, you would consume less. It's just the stasis of the body, how those are really disrupted by sugary drinks. And that was fascinating for me, just thinking about that. It's not a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, which has been a long time rallying cry behind Big Coke. What are some of the other pretty egregious methods that you discovered that Coca-Cola Company has perpetrated on the American people and all over the world?
So the calorie is a calorie is a calorie is a big one that they even developed, you know, very sophisticated front groups specifically to pitch this message. And as I detail in the book, you know, they were essentially exposed in the New York Times and had a lot of egg on their face for that particular one. Another thing they've done, you know, very, very effectively is to develop front groups. And some of those are longstanding front groups like the International Life Sciences Institute. And typically like that, the name sounds really benign. I mean, what's wrong with International Life Sciences, right? But they're funded by industry to carry industry's water for it. And so to make, in that case, sugar looks less risky. And another way that they do this that also involves front group is to fight soda taxes with groups that are that have very obtuse and benign sounding names. And so in California, they were able to effectively preempt new soda taxes for up to 30 years. And that involved using one of these front groups and running their money through, you know, Beverage Association, California Beverage Association, into this front group so that it was really difficult for the layperson to understand where the money was coming from. But yeah, those are some of their strategies.
Yeah, I have a personal high horse about organizations or also legislation that is deceptively named. That drives me insane because if you're not only informed, but deeply informed and looking for it, you can easily believe something is supporting something that you're against or against something that you're supporting. It's interesting.
Yeah, and it's a cynical strategy and it's a very effective one. So it's easy to get, I agree with you. It's frustrating, yeah.
It is, and there's so much information that we're getting all the time. If you're not spending a ton of time looking underneath who's providing that information, where is it coming from? Like I find it's getting harder and harder to know who to believe. How can we do that as consumers?
Wow. Well, and you asked this at a very interesting moment, of course, with, you know, Bobby Kennedy with RFK Jr. running, you know, DHHS. And so it's tricky. You know, I think the most reputable nonprofits, I mean, you were talking about nonprofits maybe taking this on as a campaign. The American Heart Association is doing it. I think if you're interested in any health advice, always trust your GP. You know, have a good doctor, ask your doctor about this stuff. You know, surprisingly, I think a lot of times diet it gets short shrift in those conversations with your doctor. But yeah, I think it is difficult. I don't have any easy answers. I would say it's more difficult to get trusted information in some ways, again, because we've got this balkanized, fractured information environment now than it was, you know, say 10 or 15 years ago. I have thoughts about RFK Jr. If you want to talk about that, if not, we don't have to. All right.
Okay. So Marie, both Mary Beth and I grew up in sort of small town America. We called it pop. I don't know, Mary Beth, pop as well. Yes. And, you know, I will say that I never drank much of it because my parents didn't allow it and they knew, you know, but I do have a hankering towards bubbly drinks. I really do. Thankfully, there's non-alcoholic beer and there is, you know, bubbly water now and made even more affordable and accessible by this Soda Stream or whatever it's called that carbonates it for yourself. Are we seeing any reduction in any sector of, you know, any audience in drinking sugary sodas because of this onset of, you know, bubbly drinks?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if it's because of or a parallel to that we're seeing, but we are seeing. So the consumption of sugar sweetened beverages peaked around the year 2000 at about 50 gallons per person in the U.S., dropped, you know, significantly, but, you know, back to maybe 1983 levels over the next 10 years and seems to have roughly plateaued. Again, I think that sort of mirrors this notion that some people have gotten the memo, others have not. So, yes, there has been some reduction. And, you know, another really great point is, yeah, I think people should understand what it is they're craving. I mean, what makes sugar-sweetened beverages so compelling is they're cold, they're fizzy, they're sweet, and they're caffeinated. And I don't think you should underestimate the last part because all of the top-selling beverages are caffeinated. So for people who do want to reduce their consumption, I think it's worth looking at how can I, you know, satisfy those yearnings in a way that's more healthy for me.
Absolutely. I always try to, whenever I'm craving something bad like that for, you know, for my health, I pound 2 glasses of water and go, I'm probably just dehydrated and thirsty. I wanted to just finish with, you know, a lot of people I think will have a Diet Coke instead of having the sugar and, you know, more chemicals. Is that better? Is that worse? What's your take on that? You talk about it in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, it's complicated, and I think the way I would characterize it is the way one of my sources does is that, you know, if you're trying to get off of sugar sweetened beverages, diet sodas can be a great bridge because they taste almost the same amount of caffeine. You can get them in the same places. Over time, there seems to be some concerns, and it can actually sort of wreak havoc with both your sense of sweetness, you know, how you perceive sweetness in your diet, and even possibly affect insulin. So I would say, you know, diet sodas, I don't think they have the degree of health risks for sure that sugar sweetened beverages do. But B, I think for a long-term solution, I would encourage you to also wean yourself off of those.
Sure. Well, this is entirely too short a conversation. We've been speaking with Murray Carpenter about his new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. And I'll just say this, it reads really easily, like you get sucked into the stories and the people who were really pivotal in the process of both supporting Coke and helping take it apart a little bit. But it also has just a lot of great references and scientific background. So if you're a person who's just interested in culture as well as what you're putting in your body, I think this is going to be a great book. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Carpenter.
Oh, well, thank you both. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.